Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is producer-engineer Joe Ciccarelli. But first, let's talk about metadata. What is metadata? It's data about data, and it's really important to your songs so they'll be found and also so you get paid. Basically, metadata has all of the information about the song you can possibly think of. What's that information include? Well, of course, the big thing is the artist's name and the title of the song. Okay, we all put that in, but some other things are really important as well. For instance, who are the composer or composers? That's really important so they get paid. How about the performers on the song? Well, that's important too, because don't forget, under certain circumstances, they get paid as well. The album title is important, as well as the label and the publisher. So again, they can be identified so you can get paid. The year the song was released is important. The track number of the album. Who's a producer? How about some contact info? How about the PRO, which means the performance rights organization like ASCAP or BMI or CSAC? But here's a few parameters that are really important that you should always include. The first is the genre of music. The second one is the mood of the music. And the third one is the BPM. And why should you include those? Well, this is really important, especially for music supervisors who, if they're looking for a song in a particular genre, for instance, they're more likely to find your song if you have that parameter filled in. And if they're looking for a song in a particular mood, once again, if you have that parameter filled in, very important. And again, BPM. So if you want to make money with your streams, with your downloads, with any kind of digital music, it's really important that you fill in all the metadata parameters. And I know it's a pain, it takes some time, and it takes some brain power to do, but it's really important down the road. And remember, you only have to do it once. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program, 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks with a Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Also, you can take your career to the next level with my Music Prosperity Breakthrough program at musicprosperitybreakthrough.com. The next thing I want to talk about is the iPad Pro, which was just announced last week. What's important about the iPad Pro? For one thing, this is the first iOS device that's an input device rather than an output device. So in other words, everything up until now, all of your iPads and your iPhone and anything that's iOS driven was much better at providing you information than it was taking it in. And that's one of the reasons why I never really bought into the whole thing about you can do production on the iPad. But you know what? I think my opinion has changed after seeing the iPad Pro. First of all, it's a bigger screen. It's about 13 inches diagonal. It's actually 12.9 inch. It's really fast. It has desktop class performance. The graphics are faster. As a matter of fact, it's said to be faster than 80% of most portable PCs. So that's important. The other thing is that there's a new smart keyboard that's available as an accessory, which if you're writing a lot, that's really important. Maybe more important for the engineers out there is the fact that there's a new four-speaker sound system, and you have three times the volume of the old iPad. I saw a demo where they were doing video editing, and they had three 4K streams, which is super high def, running at the same time. So that means just about anything audio will work really well on this iPad Pro. So I have very high hopes for this device. I think it's going to be the first time where we can actually do real audio production on an iOS device using a touch device. It's very cool. So check it out. It's going to be available in November. And once again, I have high hopes for it. I'm probably going to run out and get one as soon as it's available. My guest today is producer-engineer Joe Ciccarelli, who has a ton of great credits, including Spoon, My Morning Jacket, Morrissey, White Stripes, Killers, The Shins, and many more. I spoke with Joe from his home in Los Angeles. First of all, you know, I was looking, I don't know what website it was. Maybe it was, I think it was Wikipedia. I was just checking
something
you out yesterday.
Out of date and erroneous information like all the other websites.
That being said, You're incredibly prolific. Just the number of gigs that you do per year is amazing.
Well, that's probably, three albums production-wise and a few mixes. That's pretty much a typical year.
Okay, I was looking more like six or seven per year, and there was 11.
Well, part of it is, too, is things roll over. You know how it seems like every album takes longer now and takes longer to be released. So things that you do in 2013 don't show up till January 2015,
Yeah,
crazy.
Right. But when you're producing, how hands-on are you? And by that, I mean with the band. How much are you in with the band, working musically?
It's all that. I mean, to me, engineering is one-tenth of the picture. Engineering is bullshit to me. Anybody can make a record now. Since the bar of quality is lowered so much, the engineering is the lowest part of the art form. To me, the most important thing is getting in there and working with the band or the artist on songs, arrangements, concept, lyrics, all that stuff. I mean, it's months of work before I ever get in the studio. And then it's at least 2 weeks of pre-production, meaning, eight-hour rehearsal days, for weeks working on song arrangements, rhythm section arrangements. That's all of it. We all have our favorite, we all geek out and have our favorite pieces of gear and microphones and blah, blah, blah. But that's so insignificant compared to getting the musical part of it right and getting the artist to stand out from the pack of other artists. You know, there's so much music out there and so much, unfortunately, music that's really not ready to be seen on a global scale. And getting people to weed through it and find the good stuff is very, very difficult. So you've got to come up with a sound, a character, a song, a melody that really, really vibrates with people, and that's hard. So, I mean, how hands-on? Every bit of it, I mean, every note of it, even when I collaborate with people, there's an album I'm doing right now that I'm working with another producer because I actually didn't have time, and it's a low-budget record to devote to the whole thing. But basically, my day is I go over every morning, listen to what they did during the day, make comments on it. They send me rough mixes at night. I make comments on those. I spent about a week by myself and with the band working on arrangements, and then a week working on the tracking, and then I'm handing the overdubs off to my co-producer on the record. And so I'm involved in every note of it. I'm just physically not in the room for these 2 or 3 weeks of the record. But, I'll be part of the mixing of it. And, even when I'm sharing the duty, I'm still very, very active.
When you're producing and a project and you're tracking, are you tracking it yourself, engineering it yourself, or are you getting someone else in?
Usually I'm doing it myself, and it's pretty much dictated by budget. Budgets are cut to, one quarter, one tenth of what they once were.
Yeah.
So it kind of demands that you do two roles. There are times when I produce records that I don't feel I'm the best engineer, or I don't feel like perhaps I'm the best mixer for it. Times when I might be working on something for 6 or 8 months and I'm fried by the time that it gets to mixing, and I don't feel like I can approach it fresh, I'll bring in somebody else to mix, and that's a decision that I make as producer in terms of what's best for the album. And there's times where I have to say, you got to step aside and have somebody else do this that isn't tied to certain balances and preconceptions of the record. Somebody that can perhaps put a little bit more fire in spots that I'm bored with. But most of the time, I'm engineering all of it, top to bottom. I mean, I would say if I'm doing three albums a year that are full productions, there's probably one of those per year that somebody is sharing the duty with me.
I always found that really difficult to do, to produce something and engineer it, especially during a tracking part of it. Just the
yeah, it's definitely difficult, and that's why I insist on the pre-production time, to know that going into the studio, I really, really have myself clear with the arrangements, that I can kind of sign off on all the musical arrangement part of it. So when I'm in the studio, it's strictly about getting sounds and getting performances, as opposed to worrying about, you know, what the bass line should be in the chorus. I will have worked that out, you know, in pre-production.
Is there someone that you feel like you got a lot of your chops from?
Wow. that's a good question. I mean, a lot of people over the years for a lot of things. You know, I started at Cherokee Studios when I was 20 years old, and the Robb brothers were very great to me. David Anderle, who was head of A&R for A&M for years, was the first one that ever gave me a production gig, and that was Oingo Boingo, and I learned a lot from David, especially how to deal with artists. Jimmy Iovine I worked with for years and learned immensely from Jimmy, but I think the one that really changed my attitude was that I worked at Cherokee as an assistant when I was very young. And, you know, I was pretty much a pop rock music kind of kid, straight tastes. And I worked with Roy Thomas Baker on a number of albums, half dozen albums. And Roy was somebody that really, really pushed the limits, you know. Up to that point, I learned that there was sort of one way to make records, and it was somewhat of a conservative, almost photographic take on making records. And I learned from Roy that it was a much bigger art form and could be much more dynamic and cinematic and abstract, for that matter. And he really opened up my eyes. And I don't think I've looked at making records the same way since my time with Roy.
Was he using the 40-track Stevens then?
Yeah, he used that. He used 24-track and everything else that was, you know, all about 1980 or 81, whatever that was. And, but it was more so his just approach to things, you know. He understood how things had to be bigger than life, that they had to jump through the speakers, that performances had to, like, you know, rip your heart out, and that you know, guitars needed to make you want to pick up a guitar and learn how to play guitar. He really grasped that. And you know, I mean, look, there's a zillion ways to make a record, and it's a art form, a minor art form at that, but I think it's crucial, especially these days with the amount of music out there, to really do something that is impressive and unusual, but yet, you know, keeps in mind the artistic vision of the artist. I mean, that to me is a producer's first part of the job is to bond with the artist and understand what they're trying to do and trying to help them achieve that. And, you know, along the way, sort of pointing out their weaknesses and not even pointing them out, but kind of, you know, shoring them up, hiding them. And enhancing their strengths and just building a bigger picture for the artist. And I've found many, and I've said this before in the past, that the more and more I find I bond with the artist and understand and agree with what they're trying to achieve, I think the better the results are. I mean, I always come at an album with a very specific vision in mind. I mean, I kind of, I don't know, not to sound arrogant, but I kind of hear the finished product in my head before I even start it. And I hope that my picture is in sync with the artist's picture. And I've found that the more that it is, the better the record turns out. And maybe not even the most commercially successful record, but at least artistically successful, or at least the artist walks away with that feeling of, like, wow, this is the album that I had in my head and I was really trying to get out. And, you know, Joe really helped me achieve that.
Well, you mentioned about how you're trying to find something that stands out in a production. And I'm wondering if you have a process in doing that. What, is it just something that hits you during pre-production? What, how does that happen?
I think it's something you hear in the song, something you hear in the artist's lyrics, something you hear in their voice and their approach. You know, for instance, I don't know, I'm attracted to artists that sort of push boundaries, blur genres, combine different styles of music. So that might be something that if that's what an artist is prone to, that I would really enhance. If they, I don't know, had a love for classical music, I would, you know, ask them to try to write a classical piece in the middle of a song, in the middle of a pop song, you know. Or if their music, I like music that takes left turns, that surprises you, that catches you off guard, that isn't too predictable. You know, I love where albums take you on journeys and songs take you on journeys. So when you think you got a band figured out, you don't have them figured out, because all of a sudden they incorporate something that you just didn't hear in the first three songs of the album. And so I really kind of push people to and try to branch out and take some chances. I always think it's important for artists to grow. I mean, I really, as a music fan, a listener, I really hate it when an artist does the same thing over and over again, album after album. I just want to see people grow and try things. And even if one fails, I think it opens up new doors for you creatively. And next album, you make something that's even more impressive, you know?
I certainly agree with you, but boy, that's at odds with record label thinking, isn't it?
I don't know if it's, I don't know. It's maybe not at odds with record label thinking. It might be at odds with what the current marketplace is. I mean, now everything sounds the same. Everything has got the same kind of pop formula. And things really don't break out from that much. And that's kind of a sad thing. And that's kind of a tough battle. So, you know, producing, you've got to balance the record company desires and management expectations along with the band's artistic ones. And you know, sometimes you're stuck in the middle. Sometimes everybody's on the same page. Sometimes you get a great A&R guy that really understands and encourages the band to do something different and really pushes them. You know, there are a few of those guys out there, believe it or not. And it's fantastic when you get to work with an A&R guy that kind of, just like you have the artist back and like you're trying to kind of watch out for the things that they miss out on, a great A&R guy can be that for you as a producer. He can be the guy that kind of sees the flaw in the song that you totally missed. So there are A&R guys out there that are really, really forward-thinking. But, you know, unfortunately, everybody has a job and a boss to answer to, and they got to have hits at the major labels. You know, working for indie labels, it's a different situation. You know, the good thing about indie labels is they really tailor the artist to the artist's market, and they want to work within those parameters. They want to make sure that they've got their core audience covered and then branch out from there. So in a sense, by thinking that way on a business sales level, they're really looking out for the artist's best interest. They're at least providing them with, like, you know, let's reach your people, let's get your people psyched, let's get them into this music and then broaden the base. And so it can be a little easier, let's put it that way, working for the indies sometimes.
Yeah, what I noticed is most of the time, the people that are running indie labels are fans themselves. They're fans of the of the artists. They're fans of the music, and it's just like it used to be. You know, way back in the early days of rock and roll, really, where you know the people that ran. Well, look at, you know, Jack Holtzman and Ahmet Erdogan and all those guys. They were signing people they really loved. And yes, that made a difference.
Yep. I mean, the difference, too, unfortunately, is that those guys, Jack Holtzman, might have been able to be in a position to give an artist two or three albums to grow and try different things and develop careers. There's not a lot of development, even at the indie level that goes on with bands. You know, you get your $25,000 to make a record and that's it. You know, they kind of hope that things just grow a little bit. And, you know, you do have situations where, I don't know, War on Drugs is a good recent example where, you know, bands definitely built a fan base and now is selling close to $200,000 records and just got picked up by Atlantic. So, you know, that's a great story where a label has developed and helped an artist and now it's moving on and hopefully it expands its music and its audience.
You know, you just mentioned $25,000 as a budget. Is that typical?
Of most of the indies, I would say that's a typical thing. There's a kind of next level up of indies that are associated with major labels, and those tend to be, you know, maybe two, three times that. And the major label budget for a starting artist is not much more beyond that.
Yeah, okay. That's in line with what I know to be, too. So how do you reconcile a small budget like that? From the standpoint
that,
yeah, I know. First of all, it has to impinge upon the amount of time that you can spend on it and also the amount of money you can make.
Yes, on all fronts. I find I spend more time on the pre-production part of it because I'm working in a band's basement or a rehearsal room, and that's very, very inexpensive to do. So I make sure the band is ready to record. I make sure all the song arrangements are in good shape, so the tracking process becomes simpler and cheaper. Then, you know, overdubs take what they take, and typically it's 3-4 weeks of overdubs on a record, sometimes 2 months, mixing, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks. But, you know, everybody's got home studios, friends studios, you know, you're working in not a major studio all the time. I'm fortunate in that I'm camped out at Sunset Sound and basically use the facility for tracking or mixing, but I'm always moving to a smaller room to do overdubs because a lot of the budgets can't handle it.
I didn't realize that that was your home base.
Yeah, it has been for like the last 10 years. I mean, I've done so many albums over there. Jason Mraz, Young the Giant, Christina Perry, Alanis Morissette, Morrissey. I've probably done 20 albums there. I don't even know in the last 10 years, more than that.
It's a great place with an amazing vibe. There are so few places that have the legend and the vibe. It's just great.
Yep. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I find like every day walking into that room, just knowing the history of it is inspirational. And I find is really great for artists, especially young bands, when they realize that, you know, that's where Janis Joplin stood and sang, and that's where Mick and Keith finished up Exile on Main Street, and that's the exact same reverb chamber that's on all those Doors albums. You know, that's that's pretty inspiring to people. I find that, you know, they really feel like they got to step up their work, and they're now competing with classic albums, you know, all the Van Halen albums, yeah. Vex records.
Yeah.
You know, that's really a great company to be in, and I find it every day to be just a joy.
I remember going to the 25th anniversary. It was 25th or 30th, some 50th, anniversary.
50th.
Okay. Yeah. Whatever it was, I was there for 3 hours, and they were playing in the background music that was made, and they were all hits that were made at Sunset mm-hmm. Sound. And they never repeated a song in that 3 hours that I was there.
Probably true. Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. Yeah, it's pretty great. Just sort of styles of music that were created there. You know, I mean, the place even goes back to Tony Camerata that did like all the music for Mary Poppins. So the stuff that you heard when you were like, you know, 5 years old or whatever the hell it was, it's all done there.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Oh, I didn't realize you were there. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Back to production here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a secret for keeping everybody happy in the studio?
Good question. You know, the certainly the job is it varies with every project, and it's one of the fun things about it is that every artist is different and has different needs, and the process of working with them it varies from project to project. So I think it's a matter of scoping out the artist and finding out what their needs are. You know, some people, some people you need to be their cheerleader. Other people you have to sit down and just tell them the truth about stuff, and or somewhere in between. You know, it changes from project to project. So you kind of spend some time. I always spend some time before I get in the studio with the artist, and you know, that might be, you know, a few dinners or hanging out, hearing songs, and then going into a week or two of pre-production. So by the time you really get in the deep end of the pool, you've had some time to kind of see what they're all about. And that's really important to me, is spending that time. I mean, you know, and that's the other part of it. The fun thing of this is that it becomes your family for months, and then you don't see people for a couple more years till you make another album with them or whatever it might be. You know, I mean, like working with my Morning Jacket guys, we just had the best time for months working in New York and in Nashville. And then, you know, I don't know, I don't bump into them for 2 years later on the road somewhere and just go out and have a great night of drinks together. And, it's a funny relationship that you build.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. How about in the studio? Do you have any techniques for getting the best performance out of musicians or out of vocalists?
There's a lot of things. I mean, I try to stay on the positive side of things, always encouraging people, always, you know, pushing them to go beyond and to sort of feel like they're in a safe environment where they can try things. And sometimes, you know, even with the budget situation, sometimes that requires, if I know that I've got a record where the artist really wants to spend a lot of time experimenting with electronic textures for the record, then I gotta budget that. I gotta like set aside that, okay, normally overdubs might take me 3 or 4 weeks. I gotta give another week or two in here, and maybe it means I got to go to some small studio of a friend, but he may have 100 keyboards in his place, and the artist can walk in there and experiment with all this stuff, and he's going to feel just great about the record. And even in the end, you only use 1/10 of it, at least he feels like he got the opportunity to try some things and go out on a limb. I think that's important, really giving people freedom to try to do things. And I don't know, just not be afraid.
What's the toughest thing that you have to do as a producer?
The toughest thing?
Oh, or the thing you like the least?
The thing I like the least.
That's a loaded question, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. That's funny. You know, sometimes, I mean, I've had situations where, you know, I guess maybe sometimes the vocal thing is tough when you go and do a lead vocal on something and you feel like, this is it, you got it, I got it, I got it, and you put it all together and you sit back and listen to it and you go, okay, it's got a character, but it's the right character yeah. for the song. Is it really conveying the message? Is it the right emotion? Is it perhaps too big, too harsh, too over the top? Or is it not big enough? Is it not emotional? Am I not connecting with the artist? And that's a tough moment when you got to go back to somebody and go, look, I know you worked your ass off for 2 or 3 hours doing this vocal, and I was really excited about it at the time. But, you know, after I put it together and sat back and listened to it, I'm not sure if it's there yet. And I even went back and I, you know, what I'll do is sometimes comp a vocal from the takes I feel are happening at the moment when they go down. I'll take notes and put something together. And, you know, I'll listen to the comp and make a couple changes. And I might go and say, okay, what might be another perspective on this, another viewpoint? And I'll try to do another comp, a different approach emotionally, and see if maybe that works a taste better. And, you know, if they have to go to the artist and go, look, I tried a couple of things and I just don't think we're there yet. You gotta try it one more time. That's never a fun moment because it, you know, I really feel for singers, it takes a moment, takes a lot of energy, for them to get up, especially when they're very personal songs that, have a lot of pain behind them, perhaps. To have to get up to the microphone and pour that all out. It's, you know, like being an actor. You got to put yourself in that moment.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is if someone really loves a performance or loves something about it and you know it just isn't working, you know, that's hard to go back to somebody on that.
Yes, it is. It is. It's hard to convince them. But, you know, usually if you've kind of gotten that trust over the course of the record, at the very least you can say, look, give it one more shot. And sometimes I've found what happens is if I get somebody to go back in and do it again, maybe they do the whole thing better, but maybe they just do the verses in a more appropriate way, or they do parts of the song that give me enough that it improves the whole picture. And that seems to work really well.
Getting a little technical for a second, how much do you do in the box these days?
A lot. Even mixing in the box. You know, I'm not a fan of it. I don't feel like I make the best sounding records. I'm spoiled working over the years in great studios from, you know, Sunset Sound to Capitol and Ocean Way and Avatar and wherever else, Blackbird, where I go all the time in Nashville, and I've had just like nothing but great successes there. And those are all big analog rooms. And I feel like my in-the-box mixes are not quite there. There's a kind of emotional element that's not as satisfying, both in the process and in the end result, that somehow I feel like when I'm done with something in the box, I kind of feel like, okay, you know, it meets all those marks, it's dynamic, but that sort of magical thing that happens with the analog interaction, let's call it, you know, the way just everything glues together and works together. It doesn't quite happen in digital, and that kind of magic marriage just isn't there. And so I'm always a little dissatisfied with the outcome. I always feel like, yeah, it's fine, it's okay, it's doing what it's supposed to do, but I don't know, that sort of like, oh wow, this just feels great. Record, we got it. That just doesn't happen.
Well, when you're mixing in the box, where are you doing it?
Where?
Yeah.
Number of places. Sometimes at Sunset, sometimes with other engineers, sometimes using a kind of hybrid system of doing some summing, doing some in the box, or perhaps mixing all in the box and then taking the mix and putting it through an analog bus chain to get a little bit more tone. You know, that's the thing I find I can never get the low end and the size and the warmth and the outside the speaker's quality to the mix. It always feels a little small to me and kind of just hashy and noisy and just never big and warm.
Yeah.
So I try to do whatever sort of processing I can outside the box, even though I'm all in the box. And even when I mix, like for instance, if I'm mixing analog console at Sunset, it still becomes somewhat of a summing box, meaning that, I may have 100 tracks of music, but it's broken out to 24 or 32 faders. So in a sense, the console is just like a big summing box.
I remember way back running into you in a number of places, and you always had an RTA across the two mix bus.
Yeah, I still use it.
Yeah, you do?
Yep. Yeah, all the time. Just to get my low end right, things like sibilant S's show up on it, and I kind of know where that fine line is and what I can get away with and what I can't. Even now, especially with electronic tracks where there's tons of, super subsonic information, it's really good to know what's messy and over the top. So, I found that to be a real helpful tool for mixing.
You're just doing it on mixing, not on tracking?
I might use it on tracking. Yeah, absolutely. But it's more critical to me on mixing. Yeah, tracking for the bottom end.
Yeah.
I can sort of see where my balance between 50 and 100 lies and things like that.
Is that what you're looking at mostly, 50 and 100?
Mostly low-end octaves. I kind of know the curves of records that I like the sound of, so there's a certain curve that I aim for.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is that curve has changed a bit over the years because pop records especially are brighter and more aggressive now, and what I might like as an overall tone might tend to be a little dark for a lot of people, a lot of pop records especially. I like to push the bottom as much as I can. I just think that, you can never have enough low end on a record.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Doesn't.
Good balanced low end really makes a big difference.
Yep, absolutely. And I've never heard anybody bitch about a record having too much bottom.
How about loudness? Does it really... Are you trying to make a really loud record, or does it matter to you?
Couldn't care less.
Yeah.
Couldn't care less. To me, it's about what's right for the song. And sometimes a loud mix is important for the song. If it's, a heavy band with big guitars, that mid-range has to be nasty and in your face, it's fine. But I'm not competing with anything, especially now. When people are listening at home and they don't know if they have sound check on or not, and they're listening in, with Sonos systems across their house, and they're listening to stuff that's so processed on so many different levels that it only hurts you to be the loudest mix in the game, because all that processing stuff is going to knock your mix down, make it sound smaller, just like what happens on the radio.
Yeah, yeah. But unfortunately, it's still a game that everybody seems to be playing. Or I shouldn't say everybody, that too many people are playing.
Yeah, I don't know. To some degree. I don't see it being the big thing that it was a few years ago.
Well, I don't know. I talked to a lot of engineers, and there's a number of A-listers that tell me the most important thing for them is volume. They have to have it. And it's because of the world, not that they like it or they want it, but it's the world they live in. It's demanded of them. So,
I don't know. I personally can't go there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when I deliver a mix to an artist and to the record label, I'm, of course, giving them a bumped up mix as well as I send them the straight 1644, 2496, whatever, to reference, but yeah, because people are listening on their laptops and everything else, it has to be loud, absolutely. But, you know, I leave that battle up to the mastering engineer and the artist and the record label. And I don't know. I can't go there with it. It's just, I'm not going to compromise what I feel is the best approach for the music, because somebody thinks it needs to be loud. I mean, if loud is the game plan, if aggression and loudness is the game plan from the get-go, of course. But I don't know. I'm not going to worry during mixing that is this loud enough? Is this?
Well, it's not your style, though. The stuff that you do, that's not your style.
Yeah, for the most part, I'm not doing, you know, real active rock records that need, that need to be really kind of bright and, you know, clicky kick drums and you know, overly saturated guitars and stuff like that.
And you're starting to get real busy here, so one more question, I'm going to let you go.
Oh, that's all right.
What's the best piece of business advice that you've ever either received from somebody or you just learned along the way?
Business advice. I don't know. That's one I find I'm still learning every day. You know, as the business changes and gets smaller and smaller, you know, I think you have to, number one, I think you have to be doing this because you love it and you want to be in it for the long term. I think the concept of, you know, going in and having hit records and getting out, there are, you know, maybe a few lucky people in the world that's happened to in recent years, but not many. But I think you have to make friends and relationships, and I find that, you know, managers and A&R guys that I've had great relationships with over the years keep coming back to you, and they trust you. And I think, really, you know what, being honest with them, I'd rather go out like that, that, you know, this is how I feel, and, you know, whether I'm right or wrong, but, you know, I want you to know where I stand and how I feel about the music and how I feel what is good about it and what is weak. And you know, I'd rather people know where I'm at and not tap dance around things or be dishonest, because I just think that it's so difficult making a record now, and it's so difficult trying to sell music that like the last thing you need to do is just like backtrack around your lies or bullshit. It's just, yeah. It seems stupid to me.
Yeah, but you know what?
But I think building relationships is probably like the best thing.
But you keep working and working a lot, and we both know a lot of very talented engineers and producers that don't, because they don't have that same attitude.
I don't know. I mean, you know, we all have our good times and our bad times. I mean, my career has definitely been up and down. I find it goes in 5-year cycles, you know. You're kind of like, all of a sudden you have a few hits and you're nonstop for 5 years, and then, you know, you don't have a hit for a year and you're back to the bottom basement, you know, trying to get gigs, and then maybe you have another hit and it builds all back up again. Or perhaps the styles of music that are in vogue are out, change, and you don't want to be a part of them. So you perhaps aren't, you know, the music that you like to make doesn't command the biggest bucks. So, you know, you got to weather that. I mean, that's something that a lot of producers that I worked with when I was engineering only, really taught me that times do change and there are cycles of music and you kind of have to learn to ride those waves, you know?
By the way, I agree. I noticed that you have, there's 8 Latin Grammys.
Something like that, yes.
I didn't realize that you were that active in that community. But the whole point is that when one thing isn't working, you go someplace else, or you have multiple things going on at once, that's a whole part of you that I didn't realize that was there.
Well, you know, it started because I really liked the music, and there were a number of Latin rock artists that I pursued and just built relationships with and worked with, and, you know, Cafe Tacuba, who I've done 3-4 albums with, Julieta Venegas, artists like that who, again, you know, I was talking earlier about artists that sort of blend genres, and Cafe Tacuba is the perfect example of somebody that took the music they grew up with in terms of their traditional music and morphed it with all the hip indie music they heard of their college years and turned it into something that was so totally unique and fresh. They're one of the best bands on the planet to me. I mean, it's such a fun experience working with them because they're fearless. And you know, I think that's part of, working in the studio. I think you can't be afraid to try anything. And, you know, as a producer, you have to build a safe environment where it's okay for somebody to go off and do something wacky. And at the end of the hour or day, you know, you look at each other and go, well, shit, that was fun, but it's pretty left field. Oh, well, let's move on. And, you know, but I think that the ability to try it, you always learn something incredible, or perhaps you come up with something that really pushes the song in a unique direction. And those guys just do it intrinsically. It's just in their blood. You know, it's just the way they think. That's the way they hear things. And it's such a pleasure I've just had such great times with all those artists.
Which has to do with music. You know, it's another thing. When I go back and I look at all of the albums that we kind of grew up with that were big hits and changed our lives, they're all in the 35 to 40 minute.
Yes. Yeah, I've had this conversation with artists a lot lately. You know what? 9 songs, 10 songs, make them great, make people want to go back to the front and play it again, and that's it. No more this 14-song thing where you're bored by the 8th song and you don't want to hear the rest of the record.
Well, not only that, it's counterproductive, I think. People don't feel like they're getting more for their money at that point. It's almost
a penalty.
No, they feel
like they're getting less. Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I agree.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. That's questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I love getting your questions and comments. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. Steve is the guy that puts together this podcast, so thanks again, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com or bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter or alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.